The story about a life. It's the story of a life. It's the story about a life. Wow, my life, their life, all life. I grow on problem.
Aléatoire à l'abattoir, écoute mon histoire. Elle savait très diffamatoire en tant que ghetto man.
Pour de vrai en vrai, ça vient du ghetto.
Paquet départ, paquet départ. Bonaventure départ. Gymnase militaire départ. Les militaires civils là. Paquet départ. Paquet départ. Bonaventure de Cochi. Bonaventure. Paquet départ.
Thank you. Episode 3. They moved towards the stairs, and I ran to my bedroom and shoved the jewels and gun under my mattress. My heart was thrashing about in my chest. Voices were raised. There was a crash of a table being overturned. "Open up, or we'll arrest you all," I could hear them saying outside Mrs. Korbeliff's room. I waited in my room. "Open up! Open up at once!" They thumped on my door. "Certainly not," I said in my most haughty tones. "I am a British citizen. You have no right to search my room." I opened the door a sliver and showed them my passport. In silence, they examined it, one after the other. Prigg was called. "It's true. She's an Anglichanka," he said, looking at me distastefully. To my amazement, they moved on. Half an hour later, they were gone. When Mr. Korbeliff returned home, I went to see him in his study. For the first time since I'd lived in the house, Mrs. Korbeliff was sitting with him. I gave them back their belongings. "Good Lord, Miss Gertie, how can we thank you?" "No, no, don't thank me. But, sir, is it safe for you all here in Moscow?" "I've always said the moral course is to remain," Korbeliff began, then checked himself, looking at his wife. I don't know." Mrs. Korbeliff, very pale but upright, suddenly spoke. "I think we should go south for the summer. Will you accompany us, Miss Gertie?" "No, Sofia Pavlovna, I must stay in Moscow," I told her gently. The embassy had advised British citizens to remain in the capital in case of evacuation. "But perhaps you'd like me to protect the house as far as possible?" We spent the next 3 days packing away Mr. Korbeliff's ethnographic collection. Then we hired a cart and transported them to the Alexander III Museum, which had agreed to store the collection. Mr. Korbeliff had procured tickets for them to Yalta. Sonia's husband had returned to Petrograd. Sonia herself decided to accompany her parents south, but the old ladies refused to move. Mr. Korbeliff was in despair. No argument would change their minds, and as I promised to care for them as best I could, Mr. Korbeliff finally agreed they should remain. He insisted on leaving me the Mauser, which I took with some trepidation, having no idea how to load or fire it. It was another lilac-scented day in May, when the old carriage was loaded up and a horse was hired to take them to the station. "Goodbye, Miss Gertie," said Pasha, doffing his cap and grinning at me. "Now I'll never be able to convince you how much I love you." I laughed. "Pasha, you are ridiculous." I stopped. He had already turned away and was talking to Yasha, telling him to drive on. In the end, the Korbeliff family left the house on Gargorinsky Lane almost without noticing, talking and arguing among themselves. I was working longer hours than ever at the English school on Terskaya, lessons that were now paid mainly in kind. One pupil, a Georgian, presented me with a bag of good black tea. All the old ladies were happy. "Take some, do, to that strange boy," said Anna Vladimirovna. At my knock, Slavkin opened his door, even a little too quickly, as though he were waiting for me, and made me jump, and some of the precious tea was spilt. I had never seen the inside of his room. The walls were covered in notes and equations, pieces of newspaper, scribbles and rather beautiful sketches. In one corner was a camera on a tripod, and in another a heap of rubbish. Broken wooden crates, bits of old planking, dirty bottles, rags, stones. "Goodness," I said. "This is your work?" I was conscious of a note of incredulity and added, "Perhaps one day you will explain it to me." I turned to leave, embarrassed. "Wait." He took a step towards me. "Why are you here? Why didn't you go south?" What do you mean?" I stammered. "You know why, but British citizens have been told to stay in Moscow." "I don't think you remained here just for reasons of safety," he said quietly. "I don't know. I felt there'd be something for me to do here."
"For the revolution?"
"Well, yes." He gazed at me, and I had an extraordinary sensation, as though it were the first time in my life that anyone had
had really looked at me. Later that night, I lay in bed and listened to the wind, an unsettling tune with no comfort in it. I sat up. There was someone at my door.
Who is it?
Slavkin, a tall, awkward figure silhouetted in the doorway.
It's me, comrade. You weren't sleeping, were you?
His voice gave way a little.
No.
He approached my bed. I did not move. My mouth was dry. He crouched beside me and spoke in a ponderous monotone. Comrade Freely, I have long thought you a very rational, intelligent woman. I have known your positive attitude to the revolution and to women's rights for some time, but when you told me your reasons for staying in Moscow, it struck me that you would see my situation clearly without sentiment. I hope I deduced this correctly. He gulped audibly. In the half-light, I saw his Adam's apple leaping up and down in his throat. In order for me to work productively, certain physical comforts are occasionally necessary. For some time, I have been wanting urgently to visit you with the proposal that we might become intimate, so to speak, that in the light of the new world we are building, we might ourselves enjoy free, mutually satisfactory. He hesitated. For a moment, my mind whirled. Then I noticed that he was trembling, the hand clutching his knees, white-knuckled. I reached across and touched him. Suddenly we were together, and he was kissing my face and pushing up my nightdress, and we were both shaking with urgency, and I was only astonished that I had never felt his hands on my waist before, or touching my breasts. And he was hurrying, and pressed himself upon me, cried out, and a moment later fell still. The whole had taken perhaps 5 minutes. My heart was galloping. I could not quite understand what we had done. After a while, Nikita raised himself from me, stood up and straightened his clothes. "I greatly value and respect your honesty and your generosity," he said, serious as ever. I sat up, flooded with shame. I covered myself with a sheet.
"Oh, I see.
Well, good night then. I'm tired," he said, retreating.
"A peaceful night."
When he was gone, I got out of bed, took off my nightdress and washed, staring at myself in the mirror. My shame evaporated, and I was filled with joy.
Shame?
No, no. Here in Soviet Russia, there was no place for shame. Here, men and women were equal. We were honest with each other, and we had no time for sentiment. I could hear my mother's poisonous tones.
"I'm afraid you're not the type men like, dear."
Every cell in my body rejoiced that night. She was wrong, wrong, wrong. The Civil War brought news of more horrors every day. In July, they reported that the Romanovs were killed. The poor girls. The little boy. I didn't tell the old ladies. I spent my evenings playing canasta with them, my ears pricked for the sound of the front door closing behind Slavkin. Then I excused myself and went to bed, waiting, shivering with excitement, under the covers for the door to open quietly and Nikita's long silhouette to approach. Afterwards, we would lie in my bed and drink Armenian brandy. Nikita would talk, imagining a new way of living. Together, we planned a commune, a place where a group of us could live together and be moulded and changed by communal living, its problems and its rewards, into real revolutionaries, people capable of building communism.
But the Korbelis, what would they think?
Well, the alternative is Prig and his louts. They will be back any day now to give these rooms away. This way, we can choose suitable participants rather than have to take Prig's people. Nikita was not the only one to have this idea. Ideological communes were springing up all over Moscow. They were a rational response to the life we found ourselves living with such scarce resources and such high hopes. So we invited Fyodor Kuzmin,
a student friend of Pasha's, to join us, and Volodya, the yardman's son, when he returned from the army. Marina and Vera Gettler, neighbours and old family friends, agreed as well. Together, we wrote a manifesto. For the first time in my life, I felt that I was engaged in a mighty, vitally important task. I had never been so happy. One evening, towards the end of August, Nikita and I heard a muted knocking and voices at the front door. We leant out of the window into the warm summer night. Two figures were waiting in the street. We could hardly make them out in the twilight. "Who's there?" Nikita called quietly. "Good Lord, can that really be you, Nikita?" came a familiar voice. "Get down here at once, you dog. Open the door to us." Pasha and Sonya Korbeliev had returned to Moscow. Outside Yalta, the Korbelievs had found a small villa to rent and had installed themselves safely. "Oh, they're quite happy," Pasha said. "But Sonya and I decided to come back to do our bit for the revolution and all that." The following day, Nikita drew me aside and said, without looking me in the eye, "We've always been friends, comrade. I hope you will do me the honour of remaining my friend, even if certain aspects, which were always quite separate from our friendship, are no longer appropriate to our relationship." Part of me had guessed immediately what he was about to say, but nonetheless I was silenced for a moment. I sat on the stairs. "The fact is that now Pasha and Sonya are here and all our members are about to move in, the time has come to devote ourselves to the commune. Do you see? We must all make sacrifices, and our physical intimacy is one of them. We cannot have couples with secrets and so on, forming divisions within the group. We must be a collective." I said nothing, determined not to cry. To my horror, he crouched down in front of me and put his hands on my shoulders. "I must tell you, Gertie, how grateful I am for your friendship. I've never known anyone like you. You have taught me so much about the human spirit, what generosity it is capable of. With you in the commune, I think we have a chance of making it work." He gave me a little squeeze and left. Was it my imagination? Or was he almost jaunty as he stepped out of the front door? I lay hunched over on the stairs for a long time, feeling the sharp edges of the mahogany panelling pressing into the skin of my forehead. Tears dripped onto the stair carpet, soaked in and disappeared. Then I heard someone coming and struggled upright, straightening my clothes. So, at the end of August 1918, the Korbeliev's house on Gargarinsky Lane became the Institute of Revolutionary Transformation. And we, its raw materials, aching to be transformed.
Thank you. I was poor in love, I was poor in wealth, I was a